As a literary agent, you know there's only one thing I like talking about more than books, and that's money. More importantly, cash that stays in your pocket. I'm on the lookout for our listeners at all times. I'm combing deal memos and book publishing contracts for hidden ways that writers are on the hook, and that's why we are thrilled to partner with Chime, who's changing the way people bank. They offer the most rewarding fee-free banking built just for you. That's right, built for you, not the 1%. Chime members can benefit from up to $1,150 in annual rewards, fee-free. Direct deposit unlocks the most rewarding way to bank at Chime. Chime is rated 5 stars by USA Today for customer service. That's real humans 24/7. You're not just switching banks, you're upgrading to America's number one choice for banking with a Chime checking account. They're not like traditional old banks that charge you overdraft and monthly fees. And if you're like me and travel a bunch and love premium travel perks like airport lounge access, you've got it. And the 24/7 travel concierge included with your Chime card. My younger self would have loved a fast-tracked airport lounge access. You get 5% cash back on Chime card in a category of your choice, like gas or groceries for your next writer's retreat. You get savings that grow faster with 3.75 APY. That's 9 times higher than the national average. You can even get up to $500 of your pay when you say, with my pay. They also have SpotMe, which lets you overdraft up to $200 fee-free. Chime is not just smarter banking. It's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. Head to chime.com/tsnotya. That's chime.com/tsnotya. It only takes a few minutes to sign up.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a JD Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks segment. As per usual, we are diving straight in. Cece, will you please kick us off?
Let's do this. Dear Cece, thanks for all you do on the podcast. Your advice, along with the lovely Carly Waters and Bianca Murray, has whipped my query into shape, and now I'd love to know if it passes muster. I chose Cece because of her fondness for dark, unsettling novels and complicated sister relationships. My book explores abandonment, parentification, and how control can curdle love into something predatory. Welcome to the Overwoods, where your deepest, darkest fears don't just haunt you, they hunt. The Whistling Dark is an 80,000-word horror with a romantic subplot. It blends the generational trauma found in Andy Davidson's The Hollow Kind with the isolation from Johanna van Veen's My Darling Dreadful Thing. It will appeal to fans of the Old Gods of Appalachia podcast and anyone who suspects the scariest monsters can be the ones who say they love you. Bowie Burnham doesn't believe in spirits. She fled Kyle and the West Virginia hills years ago, trading small town superstitions for the ordered life of a Chicago accountant. But when her sister, now the host of a paranormal podcast, invites her home, Bowie can't refuse. Family runs deep in Appalachia, even when it's fractured, and Amber is the only kin she has left. Amber has promised 6 lucky fans a weekend adventure at Etta Rake's farmhouse. Legend says the mother-turned-monster sews her victims' faces shut and traps them in the Overwoods, a forest stitched over hours like a second skin. But Bowie knows the truth. The woods are where the drunk hunters and foolish flatlanders get lost. And Widow Rake, she fabricated the damn story. That monster is no more real than her mama's promises to stay sober. At least that's what Bowie tells herself, until the whistling starts. Soon, the scarecrows don't stay where they're staked, fuel lines get slashed, and guests vanish into the fog. Bowie suspects Amber is manipulating events for internet fame. But when the first body appears, gutted like a deer, the Overwoods stop looking like folklore. Even Kyle, the drug Bowie could never quit, begins to believe. As the trees close in, Bowie realizes the Overwoods doesn't attract monsters. It makes them. And something has been waiting to bring her home. By day, I'm an award-winning political journalist who writes about energy issues in Appalachia. By night, I'm a horror superfan and freelance fiction editor. When I'm not writing, you can find me hiking, baking, or wrangling 2 wild but wonderful tiny humans.
Awesome, Cece. Thank you so much. I always struggle so much with the pronunciation of Appalachia. I used to say that, and then David Joy corrected me, and he was like, it's Appalachia. And
I always say Appalachia. Appalachia.
People say it in wildly different ways. So I know this
and then,
because
depending on your accent, right? Yeah.
No, so the thing, it's like, kind of like New Orleans. Some people say New Orleans, people say New Orleans. Like, it varies wildly. I know this because in my school, there were people from like all over the states, right? Like literally every part of the states that you can imagine. And because everyone was an expat. And I remember being like, I thought they were different places when I was really young. Like when I was 7 or something, I was like, these are different places because they sound so different. And everyone just says it differently. It's really weird.
Well, I'm sure we'll get comments on the YouTube channel below, like showing us exactly like Appalachia or Appalachia. So spell it out for us, guys. Make sure we don't embarrass ourselves.
But you have to live there to tell us how to pronounce it. You can't be telling us how to pronounce it if you don't live there. This is for people who live there, all right? Okay, so Cece, how many words was that? And give us your take on that.
So that was 411 words. Okay, so if you're on YouTube, you might have seen me suppress a smile when I read the very, very first paragraph, that paragraph that's just for the podcast. This person would obviously not include this paragraph on a real query letter. And the reason is because I received a very mean DM the other day about how everyone has been talking about how we read these paragraphs addressed to us on the podcast. And it's so cringe that, you know, they feel so bad for writers who have to like gush about us before we will critique their work. And anyway, it was a very long DM, which I did not respond. I don't respond to most DMs. I don't have time. And anyway, the reason why I suppressed the smile is because my first reaction was like, oh my God, do people think they have to write the very nice paragraph? Like nobody has to write that very nice paragraph. I think they do it because they want to. And then my second thought was, why am I overthinking this person's rude DM? In case anyone out there thinks that they have to gush, you really don't. It's so appreciated because kind words are always appreciated. We are human beings. But I promise I speak for Bianca and Carly when I say, you do not have to write nice things about us if you do not want to. It is not going to influence our judgment of your pages. Anyway, I had to say it after reading that and going like, apparently everyone's been talking about it. And I'm like, why?
Listen. I assume that there's a Reddit out there about us somewhere that I've never been to and I never want to go to it ever. So I'm sure there are people saying stuff about us that we just don't need to care about. And that's fine. And that's just the internet.
If you want to influence my decision on anything, send pictures of raccoons as part of your query letter. And that will highly influence me. It's probably the only thing that will influence me. Otherwise, it's really not. Okay. Carry on, Cece.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, so let's start from the top of the actual query. I really like the welcome to the overworlds where your deepest, darkest fears don't just haunt you, they hunt. It's very short. And while I do like metadata first, if it's like a very, very short salesy line, it can be really interesting. So I thought the person did a really good job here. I looked up the sales for the two comps, The Hollow Kind and My Darling Dreadful Things. My Darling Dreadful Things sold really well. It has 18,000 copies on BookScan, obviously an average. The Hollow Kind, not so much. Like it did okay, but it didn't do, I don't know that it sold well enough for you to use it as a comp. So I would maybe take a look and maybe find a different comp just because it's important that your comp have really strong sales. But otherwise, I understand editorially why you picked them. I looked up the books. I haven't read them, but I looked them up and it makes sense. As a reminder, no, BookScan does not capture all sales. I feel like people know this already because they listen to our podcast. Okay. One thing that I feel very strongly about, and I think that I really wish the author were here so I could ask her. A protagonist returning home is a wonderful place to start a story. Wonderful. Because there's the contrast of who you used to be and who you are now. There's also the pull of the regression that comes with being around people who were a part of your childhood. Like you made a whole new life for yourself, right? But then when you go back, there's always that pull of like who I used to be and the way people see me and the projections and the traumas. So amazing. However, you are using a verb, invites her home, her sister invites her home, that I personally found a little like, it's almost like it leaks the tension a little bit. An invitation is something that you can refuse. An invitation can arrive at any time. It doesn't feel sufficiently compelling to bring her home. I feel very strongly that there should be a reason why she essentially can't say no. Like, yes, it should be a choice, but it's one of those choices that like, I have to go back, you know, like I have to. Or else, and we'll get to this when we talk about the pages, but the fact that it's so hard for her to go back, like, just don't go, you know? The fact that she has a choice to simply not go because it could be any other time and she can see her sister potentially in a different scenario, I think it leaks the tension a little bit. So I would reconsider. The verb choice is making it seem like a casual request. If it's intentional, if you want it to be a casual request, by all means, keep it. But the subsequent lines seem to suggest she's being compelled home, not just merely invited. Like, she can't refuse, you know, only kin she has left. Like, why now? I guess that's my question. The other paragraph, the one that starts with Amber, made me think this was dual POV, but I don't think it is. And so if it is, I really want clarity on that. I think it's really important to be super clear. I'm confused about how far into the story does the body appear? Like, is it the inciting incident? Because if so, that might be coming too late. In the query letter, I mean. If it's not, then I'm just wondering, like, do we have enough plot points with causality to lead to this? Like, if it's the climax, do we have enough? I was confused about order, like, when exactly this happens. Here's what I know. I always like to do this after I read a query letter. Like, what do I know about the story? The protagonist left her superstitious home to lead like a normal life. She returns home. She goes on her sister's podcast retreat thinking the supernatural rumors are nonsense, but then a dead body appears and she begins to believe the woods are actually haunted. And then what? Like, what is her goal? Why can't she just leave the woods? Like, to me, that's the biggest question. You know, they're in the woods. Why can't they just leave? This place is haunted. This place is messed up. Go home. There has to be like a more...
Because there's a bear there and Cece's in the woods trying to make friends with the bear.
Yes, well, and then if the bear is there, it becomes a different genre. It becomes a cute story, like a children's book, where Cece's friends with the bear. So yeah, I kind of wanted to know. If I'm being super honest, I think there's a lot of potential in this story, but I thought that this query letter reads like someone heard the story from someone else and then wrote it, as opposed to the writer wrote it. Either that, or the writer didn't want to give us spoilers. And so they spent a lot of lines on mood and atmosphere. They're really great lines, but didn't really drill down to the plot as much. So it's one or the other. These are my two theories right now, because there were just so many vibes. And I've noticed that when you ask someone to share, like, you know, tell me about the story, and they haven't actually read the story, they focus on the vibes. They don't focus on the plot. So, yeah, those minutes.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, handing it across to you.
All right. I really liked this query. Like, it was very vibey, but when you actually drill down, I do actually think there is a healthy amount of plot, but it's also a longish query letter, and there's a lot going on. I mean, you know, Cece's already hit a lot of the high notes, but I'll start at the top with my notes. The Whistling Dark. I like this title. I'm a little bit worried it's not that memorable. And I haven't done a deep dive on Goodreads or anything like that to see if there's other titles like it. But just a reminder to everybody to check your titles on Goodreads, just to make sure, you know, there's nothing else out there that's recent. A lot of times people will ask, you know, there is something out there like my title. What do I do? Then I will usually say, you know, is it going to be published into the same market? Meaning, was it a fellow thriller author or horror author published by Big Five in the last 5 years, then we can't really use that title. If it is YA versus adult, and, you know, there's a very clear delineation between markets and who we're focusing on, potentially you can use the same title. If it is a self-published title, again, that's a different market. So often if there is a self-published title, then you can use it if you're pursuing TradPub, because these are two different markets. So you see what I'm saying about how we kind of make those decisions? So just some things to think about. So I like it. Again, is this the most memorable? Okay, next up. I really, really liked a number of lines here. And, you know, I really wish we could go back to the days where we didn't have to talk about AI every effing podcast, but we do, and we have to. Like, one of the things I think that is going to be so crucial for people to stand out in today's market is how we can demonstrate that there is such a personal touch and such a command of language that all of the human-authored books are going to stand out amongst AI. I choose to believe as an optimist that as an agent, my training has led me to believe that I will know when things are written by humans. I think there's some lines here that suggest this is so human authored in such a wonderful way. Like this line, anyone who suspects the scariest monsters can be the ones who say they love you. So powerful, so good. Love that line. Another line, a forest stitched over ours like a second skin. Beautiful. Love that. And then the whole, you know, she fabricated the damn story. That monster is no more real than her mama's promises to stay sober. Love that. Like, there's so many beautiful lines here. And I think in this era of how do human authors, I hate that I have to say that, how do human authored books stand out in this marketplace? It's going to be things like this where there's just like, you're demonstrating your ability to be full of craft and just brimming with craft and voice. And these are the things that I'm honestly just trying to be honest with you guys. Like, these are the type of things that I'm going to be looking for as an agent to make sure that I feel the kind of energy being passed from the author to me via this query letter. That's how I've always imagined query letters. It's like the energy, you know, that the author creates through their manuscript put into the query letter as a sales tool, you know, as it comes to me, but it's really an energy transfer. You know, it's an energy transfer from the author to me. When I pitch the book to an editor, that's another form of energy transfer. And, you know, again, I'm getting woo-woo on us, but yeah, I really believe in all of these things. And the way that authors choose to use language here is going to be just such an important tool in how we kind of make sure that we, you know, just stay true to our craft. And that's why we're all here. And I know there's a lot of fear out there. And I just kind of wanted to highlight some of the things that I am looking at, because I think this was really well done.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Okay, Cece, we are now discussing what was in those opening pages.
Okay, so we have the protagonist in a car with Caroline. She is returning home. She sees scarecrows, like the first, the second, the third. And Caroline's like, you could have warned me about the nightmare scarecrows. Caroline asks her, how long has it been since she's seen her sister, Amber? I mean, the protagonist responds, you know, besides the funeral, last Christmas. So she arrives home. Through interiority, we know that they had very different mothers, the protagonist and her sister, because their mom got sober once her sister was born. Her sister's much younger. And so they were raised by opposite versions of the same woman. So they arrive. It's very clear she does not like her brother-in-law. And yeah, so the front door opens, the sister's there. She's feeling like this was a mistake. There are many, many references to this is a mistake. She shouldn't be here. And she's really thankful Caroline's there, because she's saying she would not survive the weekend without Caroline. So yeah, that's what happens.
Okay, great. So will you let us know if you think the author is starting in the right place and your take on that?
I mean, so, okay. The first line is brilliant. The first scarecrow appears 5 miles outside Welton. It's specific. It's intriguing. It's interiority. It's great. It's like the protagonist observing through her own unique lenses. Love it. The second line just is like to the point of, again, we read a lot. To the point of it being like almost showing off because it's so good, you know? Like, congratulations to the author. The imagery is so beautiful. She stands in a yellow hayfield beside fence posts that sag like drunk old men. Like, beautiful, beautiful. When I, as an agent, read a first paragraph that has such beautiful imagery and beautiful writing, what it does to me is that I forget I'm reading for work. You know, I just forget. All of a sudden, I'm reading for fun. All of a sudden, I'm in my bed at night with my book and I'm being transported into a different world. And I feel trust, because that's what it comes down to. It comes down to me feeling like, oh my God, I can trust this author. You know, I'm in the hands of a really talented storyteller who has really engaged their imagination in the story, which means that I can engage my imagination in the story. So I'm wowed by this person's writing. I want to now be annoying and picky. I want to make it clear. This is very good, okay? Your pages are very good. So, so good. But now I'm going to be annoying and picky. Coming back to what I said in the query letter. She clearly does not want to be there. There are plenty of references. Not too many. Just the right amount. Smart references. Baked into the scene. Good. But there are references to she doesn't want to be there. So then why is she there? You know? It can't just be a mere weekend, a mere invitation. It's too plot convenient. Oftentimes when I ask storytellers, what's the reason she's there? Why does she have to be there? They give me this look, and I can translate the look. The look is saying, because I need her to be there so the story can happen. That does not cut it. I'm so sorry. That is not compelling enough. You have to come up with the reason why she is actually there internally for her psyche, right? For her family dynamics, for her power dynamics. Like, that is essential. So that's something to consider as well. And then the other thing, and we talked about this, it was a few months ago. The protagonist is with Caroline in the car. She and Caroline are very close. And Caroline asks, how long since you saw Amber? And she responds, besides the funeral last Christmas. That is not believable. When the protagonist invited Caroline Caroline would have asked, your sister, how long has it been since you saw her? Like, this conversation would have happened at a different moment. It would not be happening now.
Or if they're best friends, they would know exactly what's going on in each other's life. Like, like they would know the last time was the funeral because that's common sense between their friendship.
Yeah, 100%. Like, and that is actually a really good point, because if she doesn't know, they're not that close, or they are that close, and this is the one thing the protagonist is actually withholding because it's the big taboo subject, right? And then there would be interiority of being like, is she going to think there's more to the story? Like, yeah. Like what exactly?
Or it's like, she did come into town and I had coffee with her, but I didn't tell you, and now I feel guilty about that or something.
Exactly. Or even like, what must she thinking? You know, what must she be thinking that I don't share this one thing about my sister and I share everything else with her? So it just feels plot convenient. And again, I empathize because you need to share information. But dialogue is not the way to do that because it feels forced. It feels artificial. If it's dialogue that wouldn't actually be happening, just share that through interiority. Interiority can do the heavy lifting. That is what is the magic of books. I also felt that there were a few missed opportunities for curiosity seeds. So for example, Caroline says, you could have warned me about the nightmare scarecrows. Is she withholding something else from Caroline? Something else about the town? If so, this is a really good opportunity for a curiosity seed because she could think, imagine what she's going to do when she finds out the other stuff I'm withholding. But not in that, like with your brilliant writing. There's just opportunities here, and I did highlight them for you. Our Substack supporters will see. And this is one of the best things about my job, where I can be like, ooh, what if you added something here? And then the author does all the work, and all I have to do is come up with the idea. It's really cool. I love my job. I also thought that you did a really wonderful job of conveying the larger culture, the world's mood. There's a line that reads, Welton's the kind of place that remembers who your mother was and who she wasn't. The type of town where folks say they're praying for you, but what they really mean is they've already gossiped your business to half the county. That zooming out and conveying the larger culture, brilliant. And again, it's baked into a scene. Like, so awesome. So, so awesome. Still, the fact that she's returning home makes even less sense to me. Because if this is the kind of place she's returning to, why is she going? You know? And I honestly don't think it's a heavy lift of a fix. I think if you know the reason, if you in your head know, you can actually weave this in a way that won't take up a lot of your time editing. Because I know this person's ready to query. Now we're asking people, right? Like we're asking people, like, where are you in the process? And this author has shared she's ready to query. In terms of the quality of the story, I 100% agree. I do think this foundational motivation of going home needs to be ironed out. And you can do this. I honestly think you can. So yeah, I thought it was really, really good. I did wonder, this is a bit more of a change. We have her arriving home and it's kind of like a no big deal, not internally, but like externally. She arrives home, her sister's ready for her, the brother-in-law's there, they're talking. And I'm not sure that this is the right setup. Like I almost wonder, what if she arrived home, but for some reason, maybe a mix-up or something, her sister wasn't expecting her. And she walked into her sister and her brother-in-law having a conversation that they might not want her to see, for example. And it could be something else, but I wanted like surprise and disruption. I wanted it to be a little bit less neat. It's like she was expecting to arrive home. Her sister was expecting her to arrive and it was all very pleasant and lovely. And yes, her interiority has layers, but I just felt like it, you know, you really want your beginning to leverage surprise because it's one of those things that if you look at all the great books out there, there's an element of surprise in a linear beginning. Prologues are often the exception. Different conversation altogether. So yeah, I thought, again, very, very good. Excellent quality. I do think that you could tinker with these elements if you want to elevate it even further.
Thank you, Cece. Especially so important in those opening pages and not even something that affects the rest of the story, right? Because like you say, if the author knows why the person's coming back, you just make that clear in the opening pages. It's not a huge change. And I've learned from my own work that sometimes the smallest tweaks, a line here, a line there, a paragraph here are the ones that make the biggest difference. And when you overdo it, so I had my beta reader, my writing group, look at something and they had a critique about a scene I wrote. And so I then completely overdid it. I added 3 pages and they were like, what the hell is this? We just wanted a line or two. So it's a constant calibration.
And the line doesn't even have to give full clarity. You know, as long as the interiority is saying she has to be there, she has no choice, the explanation can actually come later. Yeah. But it can't just be missing altogether, or else I'm like, just go home, lady. If this place sucks so much, you know?
Yeah. best to leverage it as a curiosity seed. Anything you can leverage as a curiosity seed, do that. Okay, Carly, handing it across to you.
All right, lots of great notes already so far. I'll chime in here. Based on the pitch, I was really excited to read, and I think the first paragraph really delivers, and CC already pointed out what a great line it is. I was really disappointed by the beginning of the dialogue. I was like, coffee tastes like burnt cardboard. Man, like, that's a saying we've heard so many times. I really wanted like something with Midwestern flair, something Appalachian flair, like, you know, something from Chicago. Like it was so vibey up to that moment. And then I read burnt cardboard and I was like, oh, that's kind of a line I heard before. So, you know, can we be more original there? That's just a perfect opportunity for us to really start to kind of get into the voice of the character, right? Because so far it's very clear you are very voicey writer, but now we're in the dialogue, right? This is where we're starting to get, what does this character sound like? So that's really, really important. The next thing I had questions about was, who is Caroline? Like, to my knowledge, she is not mentioned in the pitch. I kind of went back a few times. I was like, okay, I don't see Caroline mentioned at all. Assuming she's a friend, you know, a really close friend, as we said. But then once we get to the point where they're having conversations in dialogue where they seemingly don't know that much about each other, if they don't know the last time she talked to her sister, how close are these people? Then I was thinking, oh, is Caroline somebody who is a fan of the podcast and just wants to come to this like retreat? Okay, that's a different vibe. Like, no idea who Caroline is. So we just need a lot more clearer markers here. And it could be both. It could be a friend who also loves the podcast and wants to come back for the weekend. But again, as Cece's already pointed out, which I'm not going to belabor, this is all the stuff that we need to figure out in interiority, which is crucial. So I just think there was some opportunities on the first page to really kind of drill down on what you're trying to accomplish here. And I just pointed out too. A line I really liked, you know, a year ago, Bowie would have bet real money that Ghost Roots would become a hobby her sister abandoned after college. She still can't comprehend how Amber amassed thousands of fans willing to pay for a weekend at the old Rake House. I loved that. That was very establishing. I would have liked it on the first page, just so we can kind of understand a little bit more of the stakes of this. Because I just felt like the dialogue, as I said, leaves something to be discovered. And if we can't nail that dialogue, then we need to move that piece up. And I've made notes throughout the pages of, you know, I was like, this is a really good line. This is a really good line. You know, something that really stood out to me was some dialogue here. So, you're sure this is it? Caroline asks. That's the Rake House. Bowie doesn't add the rest. Brilliant. You know, it's not like the rest, meaning like what happened in the Rake House. Clearly there's a whole story here. Really, really liked that. That was like such an example of restraint that, like, so well done. So there's just tons of great lines here. But again, I made another note on page 5 that says, Bowie's mouth twitches into a smile. Thank goodness for Caroline. She'd never survive the weekend without her. Who is Caroline? Like, at this point, I'm like, is Caroline her girlfriend? I was starting to get like sapphic vibes. Like, are they roommates? Are they partners? And that, you know, it's her person. And that's why she brought her. Again, I have no idea who Caroline is. I would love to know who Caroline is, because I really think that would help a lot in these opening pages.
I just want to say, if the author's listening and she's going to clarify who Caroline is, please, dear God, do not name-splain it. Okay? Do not add a line. Caroline, my best friend. Carly's not suggesting this. I'm just want to make very, very clear. Caroline, my best friend, sat across from me. Please, dear God, do not do this. Okay? Do not do this. Find a subtler way to do it. I am sure you will, because you're so brilliant. Perhaps she could compare how her sister Amber sees her versus how Caroline sees her and be like, it's so interesting how your best friend that you made as an adult sees you differently from your sister who's known you her whole life or whatever. I don't know. Point is, please, dear God, no namesplaining, people. No namesplaining. Yeah. You go to jail with namesplaining.
Yeah. Even I was thinking of a way to kind of subtly work it in, because I think Caroline's driving, if I recall. There could even be a line about, like, whenever we go on a road trip, Caroline always drives. Something to the effect of, like, showing their closeness, or, again, you can kind of elaborate on the last time we went on a road trip to blank or whatever.
Yeah. Sweet Caroline comes on the radio and she thinks, and they start singing along to it. And they're like, we've always sung this since the third grade when we went on that school trip. You know, that tells you they've got a lot of history together. They've known each other since the third grade or something like that. There's really organic ways to build that kind of thing in. Okay, so before we move on to Carly's query letter, we first have a message from our sponsors.
If you're one of those people who find summer wardrobes tricky, the key is finding items you can wear on repeat, comfortable colors on trend and right for every occasion. That's why I love Quince. They make elevated essentials using premium materials like European linen, organic cotton, and washable silk without the traditional retail markup. Quince has 100% European linen. Pants, dresses, and tops are the pieces you'll reach for all summer long. They're lightweight, effortless to style, and start at just $32. I got the European linen black drawstring shorts, and I adore them. They're polished, while being casual, and go with everything. Their denim is soft and comfortable. Their organic cotton sweaters are perfect for layering when evenings cool down. Quince's beautiful 14-karat gold jewelry adds a subtle finishing touch. Simple hoops or delicate chains make even the most effortless outfit feel intentional. I have the gold U hoops and wear them literally every day. If you watch our clips, you will see me in them. Everything at Quince is priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. Make your summer wardrobe feel easier. Go to quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cheesenotya.
Hi everyone, it's time to register for the next beta reader matchup, with the matchup emails going out on the 8th of September. As per usual, you'll be submitting 3,000 words from your work in progress, and I'll be matching you up with writers in similar time zones and or genres. Many of the beta reader groups turn into writing groups with a lot of longevity, which is always marvelous to see. To sign up, go to my website, biancamurray.ca, and go to the Beta Reader Matchup page. I look forward to matching you. Okay, Carly, will you please read us your query letter?
Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, your podcast newsletters and online classes have been an invaluable resource in my quest to become a published author. Thank you so much for everything you do. You know why I'm laughing. If you have fast-forwarded through this episode, you know why I'm laughing.
They've ruined it. And the lovely and people just, for me.
I really want everyone to know that not one of the three of us picks the query letters that we read on the show. We have incredible podcast assistants, Alicia, Rosanna. They actually pick it. So it's not that nice words are working on our egos. But anyway, sorry, Carly, carry on.
On we go. Okay. The forest is full of monsters, but only one of them is sworn to protect Yuli. My dual POV young adult romantic fantasy, Eyes So Crimson and Cursed, is complete at 92,000 words. It combines the menacingly magical forest of Where the Dark Stands Still by A.B. Pornick and the rom-com banter of This Vicious Grace by Emily Theed. All her life, 17-year-old Yuli's parents had two ironclad rules: hide your magic and never go into the forest. Breaking either is a death sentence. When her ploy to infiltrate the warlord's forces goes awry, exposing her magic, she's willing to risk being eaten by monsters for a chance at reaching the castle where her parents are imprisoned. But the worst thing the sentient wood steers into her path might be a human, one with crimson eyes, the mark of blood magic, just like the warlord who tore her family apart. Raised inside the forest by his immortal ancestor, Cade is determined to gather enough magic to rid himself of his humanity and earn true belonging in the only place he's ever called home. He just has to survive a crossing, but every attempt has failed. When he encounters Yuli, teaming up could be the answer to both of their problems. She has the healing powers he needs, and he has destructive magic she wants to use against her enemies. Yuli can't trust a blood mage. But when Cade swears an oath to protect her, she reluctantly agrees to join forces. As they're pursued by the warlord's relentless mage hunters and stalked by bloodthirsty monsters, Yuli discovers that Cade has his own reasons to hate her foe. She hopes their growing feelings may be the final push he needs to pursue revenge with her. But thanks to their crossing, he's close to reaching his goal of attaining immortality. He refuses to leave the forest, forcing Yuli to choose between love and rescuing her parents, a task that could be impossible for her to take on alone. I'm an AUDHD-er with a lifelong love of stories, particular fondness for sword sorceries, and slow burn romance. The fight scenes in my book are informed by my years practicing kenjutsu, including living at a dojo in Japan. Eyes So Crimson and Cursed will be my debut novel. This query is 410 words.
Thank you, Carly. Great that they gave us the word count there. So what is your take on this?
All right. I looked up the comps because this is not a category that I am super familiar with. Both of them looked like they were on point, recently published, you know, all of the things that we look for. So I thought that was great. When you said rom-com banter of This Vicious Grace, I got a little worried. I was like, oh, is she trying to comp a rom-com when we're, this is a fantasy? But it is a fantasy. It is categorically correct. You're just kind of saying it's the rom-com that I'm comping to. So all of that made perfect sense to me. There's a lot of things that I just really like. You know, I like the line, but the worst thing the sentient wood steers into her path might be a human. What a great line. I absolutely love that. I thought it was just so well done. The one thing I couldn't quite wrap my head around was this concept of the crossing. I wasn't really sure if this was like a physical crossing or a mental crossing, or this was like the body crossing over from, you know, mortal to immortal. I wasn't super clear on that. So I would focus on making that more clear for the reader. The stakes, I think they're really high. And at the end of the day, it's kind of like love or immortality, family or love. And they also seem like stakes that you can't go back on. Like once you've made your decision, it seems, again, based on this pitch, that we can't go back on the decision, which makes for very, very high stakes, which I really liked. So I thought that was absolutely well done. The last paragraph, the author bio paragraph, also really loved it. For the sake of this podcast, I'm assuming you kind of kept the biographical details light. For your future pitches, I would include where you live. And again, if people don't feel comfortable doing that, like a region is always nice. I got the sense that you don't live in Japan anymore, because including living in a Georgia, it just kind of, I wasn't clear on if you're still in Japan or not. So I would just try to make that more clear. It's just information that we like to know about writers, and just for no other reason, just other than it just kind of grounds us in place and just helps us get to know you a little bit better. So for this, as I said, not being one of the categories I work on a lot, I was able to follow along. I enjoyed it. Again, I thought that the stakes were high enough. The only thing I might suggest moving around is it takes us until kind of the lower half of the first body paragraph for us to understand that the parents are imprisoned. I might move that up higher, because in the first line you said all her life, 17-year-old Yuli's parents had two ironclad rules. You get the sense that, you know, they are, you know, a family unit. And then like lines later, parents are imprisoned. I don't know if there's a way to kind of incorporate it at the top. All her life, 17-year-old Yuli's parents. I don't know. Da, 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 you know, I don't know. Somehow in that first line, if you can fit in that they're imprisoned, I think that would just help with the stakes early on, because it clearly affects her motivation, which I think is very important to establish much earlier. But that's really my notes. I think there's a lot of great writing here.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, your turn.
Just want to applaud the note about moving up the parents being imprisoned, because it's buried right now in the paragraph. And like, that's a really great plot point to highlight, because it gives her the motivation. Like any reader could get behind, yes, she is going to have to infiltrate the castle and she is going to have to put herself in danger to save her parents. Like it is something that makes us connect emotionally. So don't bury that, because you have a great plot. I thought that this query letter was on the longer side. And a little, like, to be honest, there's a lot of excess fat. I did highlight the lines, our Substack supporters will see this, that I felt were moving the story forward. There are many lines that are not. It's true that you need lines to establish who each protagonist is. So, you know, a line about her and a line about him, just, you know, establishing their sense of place in their world with hints of power dynamic. This is true. But like, we're talking one lines, maybe two. They're way too many focused on things that are not moving the story. I have two big picture notes, and they're actually connected. You're promising me dual POV, which means that in order for this to be successful, I have to be equally invested in both POVs. A great dual POV novel is one where when I'm in Yuli's POV, I'm like, oh my God, Yuli, yes, I'm invested, I'm rooting for her. And then her POV switches to his POV. What is his name again? Kate. And I'm like, oh man, I miss Yuli. But immediately I'm like, oh wow, now I'm really invested in Cade's. And now I'm like, Cade. And then I go back to Yuli. And it's almost like you're choosing between a brownie and a cookie and you love them both. You know, they're both so awesome. The way you're framing this, it makes me think like it's Yuli's story. Like, first, there's way more on her quest with specificity. His quest is very vibey right now. But more importantly, the major dramatic question is all focused on Yuli. Yuli has to choose between love and rescuing her parents. First of all, I don't really think that's a choice, because this guy doesn't love her if he's not willing to help her. Like this, he's an awful person. Are we supposed to root for them? I think we are. And I'm not going to root for this big jerk who's not going to help her.
You know, like if he has a really big reason why he can't help her, then I kind of need a sense of that. So it's, this is why I'm saying my two notes are connected. Like I'm more invested in her POV than his based on the query letter, which I would not be concerned about. But if the pages reflect that, then that's a problem. And then two, your query letter needs to have both major dramatic questions for both POVs. And if they have, if they're in conflict, you need to be prepared to give me a reason why I'm still rooting for them if you want me to. So I don't know. This is also not a genre I read in widely. So you are very welcome to ignore my notes. Anyone is always welcome to ignore my notes. I loved the line. I have a particular fondness for swords, sorcery, and slow burn romance. What a great line. You know, the author paragraph can be really simple. The author paragraph is not going to make or break any query letter because it's about the story. But sometimes writers find a way to like infuse their own personality and great writing in a way that's so tight. And it's amazing. Like, I loved it. I thought it was really good.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly, what was in the opening pages?
All right, so we start in Yuli's point of view. We start with kind of a reinforcement of some things that we know, which is the rules that the parents had for her. Hide your magic, never go into the forest. And she said breaking the first had ruined everything. She was determined to obey the second. We start with her kind of foraging close to the forest for different herbs and things like that. She's kind of at the wood's edge. She's kind of metaphysically feeling some energy from the forest, but trying to ignore it while she goes about her duties of picking some clovers and things like that as she brings them back. She heads back to the place where she seems like she works in a medicinal capacity, healing. I believe it's kind of like soldiers. And then we find out towards the end, I think it's the opposition soldiers that she's also healing. But basically she's foraging, putting together some sort of like potion of some kind. And then we find out that it will be poisonous to induce vomiting and diarrhea. And because she's trying to escape, presumably so that, you know, other people get sick and she can kind of take off. And so she's not going to follow the rules of staying out of the forest because she is going to take off. And so she kind of has an interaction with the cook. The cook, I believe, takes some of the potion and then she kind of takes off and sees some kind of ominous soldier type of people in the woods. And that's when she takes off.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, what was your take on them?
All right, as you can see by the way that I tried to explain this, I am not clear on a lot of these details. You know, a lot of it I'm like, I think this is what happened. I think that's what she was doing. I think this was the intention. I could not tell you definitively some of these things. You know, sometimes as an agent, I think, did I not sleep enough last night? Did I not have enough cups of coffee today? Like, am I not dialed in enough to kind of fully understand what's going on? Or, oh, Cece's showing me she has two cups of coffee. Yeah, I made one cup of coffee. And then my second one right now is tea because I'm like, how many cups of coffee can I drink before 11 a.m.? So this is an example of like, I think the writer was trying to be, you know, maybe they're trying to think like, how do I elevate this or how do I save some suspense for later? But I really strongly feel that the first page really just genuinely seems like a normal day in this person's life, right? It's like she wakes up, it's morning, it's early, sun's rising, she's foraging. Why is this day not like any other day? I don't find out until much later, oh, what she's foraging for are things that are poisonous. And that's the whole point, is that she's foraging these specific things, trying not to get caught. It's I just felt it too subtle, to be perfectly honest. And it's, again, not that anything's wrong with it, but I felt like I read it closely, and yet I still, again, feel like I'm not fully sure what's happening. So I would just, you know, if there's anything we can just like tighten a little bit, tighten the screws, just so we can really make sure that everybody fully understands what is happening. One of the things that I think could really help here on the opening page is if you allude to the concept of how does she feel about this being the last time she's going to pick plants in this location? How does she feel about the last time she's going to watch the sunrise from this vantage point? Like something to the illusion of like, this is the last time she's doing this because she knows what she's going to kind of cook up, you know, pun intended, on future pages. So something about that I think would help. Even if it has to be she's up before the sun because she doesn't want to get caught, it just felt like, oh, we're waking up with a normal day in this character's life. So a little bit of like, why are we waking up a little bit earlier than normal? Why is this the last time she's going to forage in this location? You know, is this the last time she's going to feel this metaphysical pull from the forest? Because things will never be the same, right? It's like, why is this the day that's going to change everything? Why is the, you know, why are things never going to be the same? And I think that's just, you know, really, really crucial here. You know, there is a lot of danger that eventually happens. You know, we know that there is a war going on, and the reason that she works this medic tent is because people come injured. So, but this concept of danger, again, on the opening single page, if I was to read that first page, I would have no idea of what was happening next. And obviously the point isn't to just trauma dump on us on the first page, but I honestly probably would have just put that first page down and been like, okay, this character having a normal day in their life. Well, you know, do I need to read about that? But like, oh, there's a war going on. There's warlords. There's danger. There's bombing. There's just so much to come. And I just didn't feel any sort of that dangerous energy on the first page. What I really liked was the cliffhanger on the last page. Really loved that. I thought that was great. So I think there's a lot to work with here. I think this is a really interesting story, but those are just my notes.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, handing it across to you.
Okay, from the top. So the first line reads, "The forest called to Yuli." And then a couple paragraphs later, there's a reference that says, "Despite knowing the danger, a part of her yearned to plunge into those unknown depths," referring to the forest. And then yet, next line, another reference, "resisting the lure, a tug deep in her soul, she continued to forge." Meaning we get 3-4 references to this pull of the forest. If this is an inexplicable feeling, I'm wondering, has she always felt it? Is it recent? Is she born with it? Has she ever shared it with anyone? Is there a practical reason for this feeling? Did it just start? Like, you're emphasizing this untethered emotion that makes it seem really plot convenient. Why? Every great story leverages two things, threat and temptation, because they are the things that leverage active emotions, fear, and desire. I am not threatened or tempted by this forest. I am not tempted to go into this forest. I am not feeling this pull, this tug, this lure. You are telling me she is feeling it, but I am not feeling it with her as the reader. In my opinion, no reader is going to. Not in this untethered way. And so you either have to move this to a different place or develop it in a different way, because you're just telling us there's this tug, tug, tug. And I'm like, I don't feel the tug. So temptation must feel believable to the reader so that they can feel it with the protagonist. In every great story, you're feeling the temptation with the protagonist. They're about to do this thing that's really risky and dangerous, and please don't do it. You're screaming at them, don't go. But you're also tempted as well. You also want them to go and to see what's going to happen. And that emotion is the emotion that makes us keep turning the pages. So I understand what you're going for. I just don't think it's landing. I really like that you have positioned her as someone who is overlooked. She, because she is a woman, she is underestimated. You've established her sense of place in a really compelling way. You've tied it to her motivation, because she's going to go into the forest and she's going to use underhanded methods to achieve her goals. So great. You did a great job there. I do think you overexplained it a little bit, because in the first page, you're saying otherwise she'd never get the chance to treat someone important enough to earn a promotion and access the castle. So to me, it's just like too much explanation. I would wait even a paragraph before you added that context. Like, make me go, ooh, why does she want to go to the castle? And then it's like, you know, because she needs, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought that that was really well done, the her place in the world, but you could stretch it out a little bit more. Love the way that you write her emotions. She's comparing emotions, like the guilt that she feels compared to the burden that she's been carrying. Like, very good. Warring emotions are a very important part of storytelling. There are some really interesting observations, like the fact that the porridge is thinner than it was even a week ago, meaning scarcity. Scarcity is very important in storytelling. So again, really, really great lines. I did feel that, and I think Carly spoke to this as well, I was confused, because it's almost like you wanted to have three different beginnings and you're like, I'm going to put them all in one. And that didn't allow you to actually develop one of the beginnings. Like, there was a lot happening, but I didn't sense that the number of plot points felt intentional and felt like there was causality. Like, it felt like you were navigating to two different types of beginning. One that was more moody about the tug and the pull and the lure, and one that was more about her interacting with Cook. As a final note, I love that she's passing when she's interacting with Cook and you have all these messy emotions. Would she ever wonder, because Cook seems to really like her. Cook speaks to her with terms of endearment. Would her heart ever wonder, would she still like me if she knew what I was? Because I think that's a really vulnerable emotion that she would feel. And leveraging vulnerability, especially in a protagonist with such strong emotions and protagonism, because she is doing things, that is a wonderful way to make us connect with the protagonist. It's a wonderful way to make us see the innocence in her. And so I would, again, if this obviously matches how she would feel, I would leverage that as well.
Wonderful. Thank you, Carly and Cece, as per usual, for your critiques. We will be back with another Books with Hooks in 2 weeks' time. For those of you who would like to submit, go to the Shit About Writing, go to the Books with Hooks tab, and you can submit there. And you really don't have to say nice things to get onto the show. I promise you, we'll pick you regardless. Okay, everyone, have a good one. Bye. Cece Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query Cece, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.